Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
In the last month here in Australia, certainly euthanasia has been a bit of a hot topic. Barbara Glidewell has been visiting the country. She served for a long time as the health ombudsman or advocate, patient advocate for the US state of Oregon. The law in Oregon does not consider giving somebody a prescription which is fatal as suicide. It doesn't prosecute doctors who give such prescriptions. And Barbara Glidewell explains how this system works in Oregon and what her role has been as a consultant in physician-assisted deaths. And this is her first choice, You and Me Against the World. That's Helen Reddy. They're singing You and Me Against the World. Barbara, why the song You and Me Against the World?
It's an interesting thing. I'm an only child, and my mother and I were very close as almost sisters. And she was a teacher, and she taught me to be a teacher. But as her days were waning, she said to me, you know, there's one song, Barbara, that I really enjoy, and it's Helen Reddy's You and Me Against the World. And I said, why, Mom? And she said, you will see that there's a part of the lyrics that says, when one of us is gone, the other one is left to carry on. And she left a legacy of me of teaching and for reaching out to people so that they could have information about choice, because she knew I was a true ombudsman.
And in that sense, there's always someone left behind, exactly as you point out, whether that's a family member, a partner, whether it's the staff who are working with you. And indeed, many of the people you met in Melbourne at this biennial conference, I think, would have had intimate dealings in the same way with patients who've had end-of-life issues. I had no idea, though, that there was such a thing as a World Federation of Right to Die Societies. It sounds possibly like it could be an uncheery gathering. What range of people and interests gathered at such an event?
Well, delegates from all over the world for Right to Die organizations, whether it's in Europe, in Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, and in the Asian countries as well, come here to talk about the experiences in their countries and where they are with this legislation. So Death with Dignity Victoria, of course, is keenly involved, and many other Right to Die groups and associations attempting to get information out to the peoples of the world about their choices at end of life.
Even as we begin this conversation about end-of-life issues, it's probably important to make a few distinctions. For example, in Oregon, where you come from, where you've had very extensive experience with the legislation that's been in place there, it's not really euthanasia that's allowed there, is it?
That's correct. Euthanasia is not allowed. And as we know, euthanasia is a principle whereby another person, and likely a physician, would inject an individual to end their life. And that is not a permitted act in Oregon. This must be a voluntary request by a competent, qualified Oregonian who anticipates the end of their life that have likely less than 6 months to live as determined by their physician. And therefore, as they anticipate those days approaching, they have the opportunity to go through a qualification process to determine if they meet the letter of the law and the safeguards that are in the law, and that they could obtain medication at the time they're qualified or later when they want it to use if their suffering is something that is intolerable to them.
Could we just unpack that legislation? Because you've been talking to a whole lot of people in Melbourne from different legislative experiences and different countries.
Yes.
What actually is allowed to happen in Oregon according to the Death with Dignity law? As we just pointed out, a doctor can't give an injection which will kill, but what can happen?
What happens is that once the patient has gone through the qualification process, a lethal dose of medication is prescribed. The patient can fill it at that time, fill the, you know, the prescription, or hold on to it and have it filled later. And at a time that they choose, they may swallow the medication on their own without the assistance of any other person to hasten their death.
So basically in Oregon, it is suicide by an individual which is facilitated. The doctor gives the prescription, but the doctor can't actually administer the lethal dose. That's something the individual does themselves.
Exactly. And if I may speak to that word suicide for a moment. In the Oregon law, using this act does not constitute suicide. It doesn't constitute Mercer killing or anything that is a criminal act. Therefore, that also does not, if the patient uses the law, and they have been qualified, they do not lose the opportunity for that life insurance benefit to their family.
There are other distinctions there as well, because, for example, in Switzerland, suicide is not a crime. Clearly, it is in Oregon. I didn't know that. So suicide is on your list of things which are a crime. There must be a lot of preparation beforehand, and you've been involved in this. What conversations do you have with the person who said, look, I'm terminally ill, I'm in terrible pain, I really want to end this sooner than would naturally happen? What conversation do you actually have with them?
The conversation starts by the individual. I'll just use the word patient, if I may. The patient is referred to the patient advocate office, or the ombudsman's office, the more likely term, where that will be the hub of information and the hub of where the conversations are held. The physician, the willing physician, comes to the patient advocate office, and in the privacy of a conference setting versus an exam setting, the patient, perhaps their family, a witness such as myself, and the physician, there's an interview conducted to try to determine what would that suffering look like that might cause the patient to want to utilize the medicine. Is there suffering right now? Is there pain if they have it being adequately managed by their own physician? Would they like palliative care referral? To try to determine what their long-held values have been regarding ending their life. Is this something that was a spur of the moment? Is there a depression involved? Something that needs to be treated before we would go on. Many, many very sensitive, intuitive sort of conversation to try to understand where the patient's coming from. And uniquely, the patient is standing there looking at us through his or her eyes, knowing that they're actively dying and that death is coming very soon. But family members are sitting there very uncomfortable, and sometimes the family thinks it's about them, such as, oh, Mom, I can't bear to watch you suffer. And that would be undue pressure to Mom, and Mom might think, oh, I love my daughter so much, I should hasten my life.
So you're actually observing the family as well and the friends and partners who are with them?
Exactly. It can be a domestic partner, same-sex partners, or family, and, of course, spouses or adult children. And so we're looking at family dynamics. If there are some really complex family dynamics that need to be worked out first, we refer them for some counseling to be sure that everyone can be comfortable. Now, get this, the patient never has to tell their family, if they choose, that they're going to take medication.
It could be entirely private.
It could be. Yes, absolutely. Keep in mind also that it never happens in a hospital, the taking of the medication. It only happens in a private home. You can never take it in a public place. So the patient would have to have some support system at home if they're not going to include their family.
Now, if I was reading correctly, and if this is still the case, the conditions have to be that patient has to be terminally ill, there has to be less than 6 months to live, they have to make at least 2 oral requests, there must be a written request, they've got to be 2 physicians convinced that this person is sincere and that's not just a whim.
Exactly.
You would also be trying to see if there's depression involved here, I think?
Yes, the doctors screen for that. And if there is signs of depression or depression in the patient's history, then there's a referral made to evaluate. I mean, naturally, why wouldn't somebody be depressed knowing that they're going to expire sooner than they planned? But if there is a treatable depression, and this depression causes the patient not to have the capacity to understand the meaning of what they're asking, then that must be treated. And often the patient's illness takes them before that could even be treated.
Something you mentioned there struck me, because I was going to say to you, well, look, surely, and it is my experience and observation anecdotally, that when people are terminally ill, when they're very much in pain, often depression is part and parcel of that. And it would be impossible to screen out people because they were depressed if you because nearly everybody is, I think, just about.
Right. The physicians are trained to see what we call a clinical depression, which is something which has been with the patient a while. It may have occurred over time, but it impairs their decision making and the clarity of their thinking. And if that's an overriding issue, then that patient would be excluded at this time until such time as it can be resolved. Not many patients come under those circumstances. They tend to be very vigorous, quite vocal, but in a most demure manner. They know their life is ebbing, and they're looking for a comfortable end, and they're looking for sort of a final act of caring, in a sense. But they also, if they have hit all the markers, for instance, the daughter graduating or a son getting into the military or an anniversary, and they've gone through all these rescue therapies and they're exhausted from it, and they're just done. Pardon that word. They're just finished. And they say, I've had enough of this. Please, I want release now. I'm done.
It strikes me already. I have a friend who's an oncologist who deals very often with patients who, after, you know, long struggles and actually almost being cured, but end up in the end dying from cancer. And that when she talks about this very often, they express themselves in ways just as you have. They have markers. I want to get to my daughter's 21st birthday. I need to get to that wedding. And they often have important events that help them in their motivation to defeat the disease, I suppose.
It's true. People can rally enough energy in their reserves to get to, let's say, the Thanksgiving dinner. I don't know if you have that in Australia.
But we don't, but we know what it is.
Okay. And to get to those holiday markers with families that are significant. Then after that, they tend to settle down and say, okay, I've done that now. I've met my family responsibility that is so important to me. And now I'm ready to lay down and rest. And I would like comfort medication given to me until such time as I might choose to take the medication.
So now I think we've laid out carefully what the situation is in Oregon. It's actually not euthanasia so much as the provision of a sufficient dosage of drugs legally prescribed for somebody to end their own life in a private setting. That's what it is, isn't it?
Exactly. You've said it precisely.
Another dimension, of course, you've mentioned the family and partners and all those other people who can be involved in the complex process of a person's dying and trying to interpret their wishes, but also the staff and medical staff, of which you're one, of course. All these people have, parts to play and responsibilities too. Is a doctor or a physician required to give that prescription under law?
No, not at all. Any physician, as a matter of fact, any ancillary personnel, they all have the right of conscientious objection to say, I choose not to participate. So it is not a fair amount of physicians who are willing to be the willing prescriber. And so it as it turns out, often the person's primary physician will serve as the second opinion, just confirming the fact the person has likely 6 months left to live and is acting voluntarily, but they choose not to be the primary prescriber.
So there is actually a conscience get out for any staff who feel that they couldn't assist in such a thing.
Even including, let's say, a transcriber who's transcribing the medical record, if they choose not to hear those words and transcribe, you know, what the doctor is dictating into the record, that they can opt out.
Anecdotally, I know in Australia where the system is actually informal, where in palliative care and places like that, there is sometimes at the very end part of life, the next dose is going to result likely in the death of the person if to control pain, for example. It's one way of looking at, you know, the very end of life. That more often than not, in the informal system we have in Australia, it's the nursing staff who are directed by physicians to do things who end up jammed up and upset because they're given an order which can cause them deep conflict inside. It sounds like that wouldn't be possible in Oregon.
No, it isn't. Any nurse, respiratory therapist, social worker may say, I choose not to, and there is no retaliation or retribution to their professional career. They're not on a list of who will and who won't. As a matter of fact, the only an attending physician, only a chief physician, not a resident, not an intern, can be involved in this process. Others can observe. But no one else is to even dispense this. And, of course, it's not a nurse who would dispense it because the patient is at home.
Of course, there's a tradition of do no harm. It came out of the Hippocratic Oath, the idea of non-malfeasance, it's sometimes called, or even the broader term beneficence these days, you know, the good effects that are always sought in medicine. There would be those who would say that Oregon's law and the things you do could undermine the overall drive of medicine and medical staff who have always aimed to preserve life. How do you reconcile that? How do you answer people who have those concerns?
Well, you know, that is a really deep and is a good question, and I'll try to answer. I think it's important. When you think about do no harm and you are discoursing with the patient is asking for relief, you know, a lethal dose of medication to end their life. It is their voluntary request. If you are uncomfortable that they're doing that, obviously you should opt out. But when you think about doing no harm, I look at this like this. It's the final act of caring in a dying patient who is actively dying. Therefore, in Oregon, we have a law that requires physicians to provide adequate medication, comfort medication, pain medication. And if it happens to have the double effect, in other words, causes the respiration to cease and the person expires, but that was not the intent, then there is no criminal prosecution for that.
That's the well-known principle of double effect, that I'm controlling pain, but the other effect, which I don't actually intend but I can see might happen, is actual death.
And for those individuals who have reckoned with the do no harm, there are physicians who are quite comfortable in providing a relief of suffering for those individuals who choose to take the medication. But the patient's under no obligation to take it, even once they receive it. They can rescind this medication, they can send it back, or they can waste it. I look at end of life as a situation which is finite. It's going to happen. I also look at this situation as, if you'll pardon me, this is an odd thing, but you know, in midwifery, we bring the child into the world. And in a sense, although midwifery is a feminist concept, you are easing the person into the end of their life. And I don't believe that's harm. I think that is beneficence. Harm would be if you're forcing a person to take a medication because you think that their life is not worth living or they have no social worth or you perceive that their life is not good. But in this case, the person voluntarily requesting an ease into the death, and I consider that a beneficent concept.
You're putting this into the context of the very end of life issues, that in that context, the principle of do no harm it's again balancing between the pain of the patients, is that how you...
Yes, it balances between the pain of the patient, the existential suffering, the psychic suffering of lying there, having people do things to them that they never thought they would have anyone do, and to have to lay and wait for the last couple of hours for death to come, struggling with air hunger or other issues which are so repugnant and frightening and scary. So by being able to take this medication voluntarily, being alert enough to do so, having qualified, the person self-delivers and is able to swallow this medication, lay down, they peacefully go to sleep, and eventually their respirations cease. And so if there is a good death, if there is such a thing, I would say that not everybody is able to have such a good death. Others may never, because they may not have a terminal disease, but they're dying anyway.
Our guest, Associate Professor Barbara Glidewell, who was longtime ombudsman in the health system in Oregon, where she was intimately connected to the exercise of what was called the Death with Dignity Law, which allowed patients to choose to take themselves a lethal dose to end their lives. This is terminally ill patients. Barbara, can I ask you how, in your life journey, in your path, how did you end up in such a position that you were sitting, talking to patients about the end of their life and trying to determine if this was a healthy and good decision for them?
You know, it's very interesting. It never occurred to me as my career was developing that that sort of laser beam would land on my desk when the state of Oregon finally approved the Death with Dignity Law. I had been ombudsman for years, so to speak, I'll say 25 years, and then the law became active, and it fell to me as the ombudsman to facilitate that and arrange and coordinate that and participate in the interviews between the patients, the providers, and all the other ancillary personnel, such as the pharmacists, the second opinion physicians, and others. My work has always constituted teaching communication skills and even conflict resolution skills. And that's a part of what I did as ombudsman, of course, liaison between the public and the government or the patient in the hospital.
Basically, as an advocate, somebody standing up for rights and checking
that
things
are done right. Always an advocate. We say ombudsman, but that didn't resonate with every citizen, so the other word was patient advocate. And so the doctors were required by our medical board at this hospital to go through the patient advocate office to see that every measure of the law was met, and then all the proper documentation, and even to debrief the providers or debrief the patient and family after these interviews to be sure that they were comfortable with what was said and that they understood clearly.
And at what point did it become clear to you that you would be involved in the process? And I think half of the people who in the end have decided to end their lives through the use of this act are people you've spoken to and assisted to come to their decision or tried to determine that they weren't in fact making a bad decision for them. When did that actually start to happen for you, when you actually sat there and started having these conversations?
Well, it began exactly 12 and a half years ago, about November of 1997. My facility and others decided that I and several should travel to the Netherlands to understand the Dutch experience before we launched into this, because ours was a public hospital. Therefore, we had an obligation to provide any public person any information that they chose to request.
Now, the Dutch actually have euthanasia because a doctor can actually administer a lethal injection in the Netherlands.
That's correct. And so we wanted to understand their long history with working with individuals who are actively dying, and to understand where they have gone with their law. But for coming back to Oregon, of course, ours was more singularly focused. It fell to me to be open enough to have these conversations and to hear people's concerns about their faith, how they've spoken to their clergy, how they've spoken to their family or not, and how actually sometimes the patients would ask me how they can bring this up with their doctor because they were afraid of almost disappointing their doctor, that they didn't want to go any further, that they were exhausted from the therapies. So I don't want to hurt my doctor's feelings. How do I bring this up?
A doctor who's been trying hard to get a patient through cancer treatment and those sorts of things.
Yes. My background also is I have a postgraduate certificate in medical ethics. And so I was chair of the Ethics Consultation Service. And oftentimes issues would come up, not about the ethics of the law, but to assist patients and their families in making decisions about their future.
It's interesting when you say you went off to the Netherlands, to Holland, you looked at what experience was going on there, where there is actual active euthanasia, where doctors can, as I mentioned, give an injection. That's not the case in Oregon, but you did see that. What did you observe about the Dutch experience? What were the things that stood out to you?
The first thing that stood out to me was their concept of acting in the patient's best interest. And I had to reckon that with, you know, how the house doctor, that's a term in the Netherlands, who is long relationship with the family and the patient.
The GP we call here, I think.
The GP, right. Can go to the patient's home and observe, you know, what is transpiring and make a determination if the patient cannot speak for themselves. But the house doctor, the GP, understands well the patient's values and wishes, the physician could have the opportunity to provide a lethal injection to end the suffering. It was very hard for me to accept that concept, and I was glad that I didn't have to reckon with that in Oregon. It just felt like I wasn't positive that it was really a voluntary request, and I'm not challenging those in the Netherlands at all.
Oh, there'd be plenty of people horrified, though, and uncomfortable with the idea of a doctor administering such an injection, though.
Exactly. So I was grateful that we did not include that in our legislation, because there are so many concerns, and that some people rightfully have, that there could be abuses. And therefore, with the safeguards that Oregon put in place, and it is a bit of a journey to go 15 days, you know, oral request on day one, oral request on day 15, and to have a second opinion physician review this and to make your written request. But it does demonstrate respect for the individual and the dignity of their life at the time that we're not just saying, oh, you'd like a prescription, here it is. That seems it doesn't respect the person in that way.
You mentioned, of course, ministers and religion there, and I'd like to touch on that too, because we're not only just talking about law here, what the law permits, We're not only just talking about ethics and the reasoning or approach one would take ethically, but there's also a level of beliefs and non-negotiables for some people as well. And I wonder, I had to look at Oregon and say, why Oregon, of all the places in the United States? How did they get this through? What's different about Oregon? And I looked at the religious denominations, and it looks, you know, roughly, you know, nearly 70% Christian, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That doesn't look weird. The largest single group, I think, are the Roman Catholics, with the largest single church there. So, you know, they'd be opposed to it. How did it get through? I mean, how is it that a referendum from the people passed this?
You know, I think people looked at their own individual lives, and they have had conversations with their clergy, those who are very ill. And they're trying to reckon their belief in faith and hope and the concept of miracle, and reckon that with the actual practicality of the fact of their physiological decline. And the small amount of individuals who actually go through this process and request it, those individuals have made peace with their faith in a way, or their spirituality, that they're comfortable, that they're not going against the values that they long held. And frankly, the suffering seems to override. They can be offered palliative care. They can be offered terminal sedation. They can have hospice with all manner of medication to relieve, you know, pain. But they're saying, I choose not to endure the suffering for the sake of life a few more days. And I've never had an individual, whether they were Baptist, Catholic, Jewish, you know, other Protestant faiths, say to me, I fear that I am, you know, losing my soul. They seem to have reckoned that they are in concert with their God or you know, their higher power, and that it is their time to slip away.
So people actually bring up their religious faith with you in the context of these conversations?
Some do. Others don't. But they refer to this as a very sacred time when we're speaking. It's the time that almost no one ever has an opportunity to have these discussions. There's sort of a mystery around death. And for so many people, I'd like you to know, they say, okay, now I can relax. Now I understand what this is about. I really didn't know how I would die. I didn't know what, you know, with my own condition, what the circumstances of death would be. Now I understand. I want to think about this. I may come back to see you, or I might not. But I am better prepared to understand the circumstance, the sort of physiological aspect of death. It seems to be something that isn't talked about.
How many people in Oregon actually go through with this? I mean, what numbers
of people? Okay, I'll give you a statistic for 2009. And that is that, if I'm correct, I don't have my notes in front of me, 95 people made the request. About 89 went through the qualification process. 59 actually received the medication, and 55 actually used the medication in 1 year. So the 55 would represent about one half of 1% of 10,000 deaths in Oregon in a year.
So it's quite low, and this is in a total population in the state, I think, of 3.8 million, roughly?
Exactly. It's a very small number, but this act provides yet another choice for people at end of life.
So some people actually get the medication but don't use it.
Right. It's just, if you pardon this expression, in the States we have an expression, it's kind of funny, it's called ace in the hole, or it's your insurance.
Yeah.
It's a backup plan, and again, I'm not being flip, but people actually who receive it say, okay, I've got this now. It's up there in my medicine cupboard. I might not ever use it, but by golly, I want it there in case I want it.
You're telling me there's a placebo effect to a lethal dose.
There seems to be. It's settling. Now they can go on with the business of living, and enjoy whatever their days are and not have to worry about those last days.
They feel they have control. Is that the issue?
Exactly.
What is different about these two places? Why Oregon? Why Washington, right next to them on the Pacific coast there of the States, have these laws and this happened almost in contradiction to what you'd expect in America?
Well, you know, in Oregon, they're very rugged individualist. You know, we started out with a bottle bill. We have very sort of avant-garde ideas about, you know, moving forward. And the state of Washington, you know, followed Oregon's law. They have the same law now. They mirrored all of our safeguards and wrote their documents exactly as the Oregon law is. And so I went up there to assist them as they were implementing their law as well.
It's an unusual system of government has been in place in Oregon for at least 100 years,
yes.
Referendum, hasn't there?
Right. It's always referendum. And so the opportunity for the citizens to put up a referendum and vote on it, and then that is in stone. So it's I don't know any other way to live.
Barbara Glidewell, longtime ombudsman in Oregon's health system, where she has overseen people using the provisions there that allow a patient to take voluntarily a lethal dose at the end of life when they're terminally ill. Barbara, I'm interested to ask you, what things would I need to say to you if I was terminally ill and I know I've got less than 6 months to live? What sort of conversation would I have with you that would convince you I knew what I was doing and that what I was doing was the right and appropriate thing for me? What sort of things would I be saying?
Well, first I want to clarify, it's actually the physician that the patient is speaking to. And I had been there always as the witness to sort of perpetuate conversation and make sure that all the questions were asked and all the information was given.
So you're in fact observing the process, as it were, rather than doing the process itself.
But I can tell you, the physicians will say, you know, how are you doing? How do you feel your physical condition is? What is it that might bring you to a day that you perceive in the future that would cause you to want to say, well, this is the day when I would like to hasten my death? Most individuals will say, when I can no longer have any enjoyment of being alive, there's nothing that gives me any enjoyment in the day, and I don't see any reason to wake up the next morning. I've had enough of all these therapies to try to reverse the situation. Now there is nothing left for me that can provide a reversal of this or give me a length of life that has any quality or any meaning to me. Others will say, you know, I voted for this law. I never thought that I would come to me that I would use it. And by golly, you know, when I get to that day when I'm most uncomfortable, whether it's somebody, changing my diapers, or whether it's I'm uncomfortable in my skin, or they have to sedate me and put me to sleep with sedation so that I can endure until my body shuts down.
All these issues of loss of dignity and control.
Absolutely.
And in the same sense, while you're observing the conversation happening and listening, would you ask questions yourself? Ever?
I do. I ask questions that I think the patient or family, mostly the patient, hasn't asked. And so, you know, if I don't hear the patient speaking up, I'll say to the doctor, and doctor, did I hear you say such and such? Oh, would you mind explaining that again? And I try to just sort of be that metaphoric person that information gets out so the patient hears everything they need to know. Physicians are generally outpatient physicians. They're very busy. They have a busy clinic, and they need to get back to clinic. So therefore, it may not come to them to ask every question that would be helpful for them to know.
I guess that if you're dealing so often with people in terminal illness, there must be some effect for you too, though. Does it ever wear you? Does it ever depress you? Does it ever make you think, oh, gee, it's hard to go to work today?
Actually, no. I've never felt that. The reason is we're finally having an adult open conversation about something that an individual and a family really want to talk about. When we go into the interview, I say, you know, we're going to have a very adult conversation today, and it won't be laden with a lot of overtones of sympathetic feelings and concerns, because I know that you're here to gather information. People after the interview often stand up and say, oh, I am so glad I came today. Finally, I understand. And it is sad to see the family members sometimes weeping, saying, I want to support my loved one, but I'm so unhappy. But believe me, the patient rarely has an unhappy countenance. They want to get on with it. They want to understand how they can manage their situation. So for me personally, I've never had a depressed feeling or a overlay of uncomfortableness about my work, because it's actually uplifting to make sure that these individuals who have asked do have the information they need.
Something you mentioned earlier in the interview when you spoke of your mother and remembering her, you said she chose not to assist, to have assistance with her own death, and partly out of respect for your position. What was the tension there, or the area that she was being careful of for your sake?
My mother lived with us, my husband and I, and she had congestive heart failure. And for her, she said that she, as long as I was there to comfort her and hold her and make sure that she was warm and hydrated as much as she wanted to be, and then we would sing songs together. She didn't need to take the medicine. It wasn't her personality to need to be in control. And that's what's so important. There are so many people who actually are quite fine with how the end of their life comes. And for others, they really are a control person. And I don't say that in a negative way. And my mother was a sweet but strong-minded teacher. But she absolutely had no need to hasten her life because she was comfortable with the situation we were able to provide for her.
I saw in reading the history of this whole experience that you've been part of in Oregon that the Bush administration actually tried to overturn the law in the first place. And I saw also that the Catholic Church, to be expected, was implacably opposed to it. But it sounds to me that you have a genuine sense that this is a good law, that it brings about good things.
Exactly so. You know, there are many reasons people do not appreciate a law. But I say this again, it's a good law because it's yet another option at end of life. And it's not about you or me, or it's not about the family. It's about the individual who's experiencing their dying. It's a sacred time that they want to be remembered in such a way that their dignity is preserved. So, again, it's so few people, but to have this available for those individuals who would prefer to hasten their death, I think it's impeccably important that that is available so long as the safeguards are there to prevent any abuse.
Associate Professor Barbara Glidewell, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I want to thank you for being part of Sunday Nights and sharing some of your experience.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.